It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett.
We're kicking off a new segment today with our friend Wisconsin native and best-selling author of The Kingkiller Chronicle, Patrick Rothfuss. He's with us today to honor and celebrate geek life.
Our formerly guilty pleasures, now out of the closet, stuff like gaming, fantasy and science fiction, cult TV shows, a creative anachronism, all things of that ilk are on the table.
Now, the thing is, we couldn't quite decide what to call this segment. Is it about geeks, or is it okay to say that it's about nerds? Now, Patrick and I talked about this, and we disagreed. So we decided to take it up on the air today. Patrick also took it up on his Facebook page. We took it up on the Central Time Facebook page. But we're going to talk about it this hour. And so, Patrick, welcome. It's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And what is your beef with the word nerd in this scenario?
Well, you know, the more that I talk with other people about it, it seems like, you know, everyone has their own opinion. I was very kind of certain in my opinion of the word until I talked to them. I feel like if somebody calls me a geek, I'm okay with that. I consider a geek to be a person who is passionate, kind of beyond the realm of pure sensibility about something. Usually that's a piece of counterculture, you know, or something that's a little fringy like sci-fi and fantasy or comics or whatever. But I do also think that people can be other types of geek, like a gardening geek or a baby geek. But after talking to more people, I will admit that there's no clear line on this.
Well, they're both words, geek and nerd, that I think originally and probably when we were all in junior high had a very negative feeling to them. You didn't want to be called that, not in front of everybody. But do you think maybe geek has been reclaimed more than, at least in your view, than nerd has?
I think geek has been very firmly reclaimed, whereas nerd, it has a few bright sides to it. I mean, nerds are smart. Nobody would ever argue that connotation of the word. But nerd really does seem to imply to me a degree of social awkwardness that's really kind of an unfortunate stereotype that we still carry with about anyone who games or reads sci-fi or fantasy or likes superheroes, that these people like live in their mother's basement and don't bathe very often. And it's just not true.
It's the comic book guy on The Simpsons.
Exactly. That's the perfect stereotype.
Well, you know, we have heard that geeks are ruling the world now, that they've come out of those basements and that they're running companies. I don't know, Bill Gates seems like he might be a good candidate for either a nerd or a geek. I'm not sure which one, but
both, maybe.
Maybe both. But maybe it's okay to admit these guilty pleasures. I mean, they used to be guilty. Do you feel like it's okay to be completely out of the closet about your geek loves these days?
It's kind of funny because if you stop to think about it, what are the most popular movies every year? You know, I mean, they're superhero movies. Now, a lot of people wouldn't call themselves comic book geeks, but everyone is really actively participating in this culture that used to be kind of shameful. I don't think it's so much that, you know, some of us have decided to come out of the closet. It's that we realize that there was no closet that we were actually in anymore. We are popular culture these days.
Well, we've had a lot of people weigh in on Facebook, as have you. We've got Darren and Boscobel on the line to talk about the nerd and geek issue. Darren, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think? Nerd, geek? What's the word?
Well, I'm personally a geek, but I have my own definition for the two. And that is that a nerd is your typical Hollywood-type nerd. You know, bookworm, very smart, kind of socially awkward, you know, into Dungeons and Dragons and all that. And a geek is the exact same thing, but plays an instrument.
So I'm a geek.
You're
Yay!
A geek, Rob.
I've been promoted. I've leveled up.
I like that.
Yeah,
geek language.
Absolutely. So that's my personal definition, and I happen to be a geek. I've worked in IT industry for a very long time. I love everything geeky, and I'm completely and utterly proud of it.
Great. Thank you so much for the call, Darren. Well, maybe that should be the last word on nerd versus geek, because we have some nerdery or geekery to talk about.
We do. And by the way, if you are curious about some of the responses, if you go to our Facebook page, there's some interesting opinions there. And if you like Patrick's page, there are about 5 billion responses as well that you can read. People have a lot to say about this. But Patrick, you brought along something for us to chew on, right?
Yeah, there is a really interesting piece of news that I just recently stumbled onto myself. And I'm going to read this right off the webpage. A lot of us grew up watching the Henson, the Henson productions, either the Muppets from Sesame Street or Labyrinth or The Dark Crystal. And so here is a really interesting piece of news. I'm just going to read this right off the Dark Crystal website. From October 1st, 2013 to December 31st, 2013, the Jim Henson Company and Grosset and Dunlap of the Penguin Group will be accepting open submissions to find the author for a new novel set in the world of Jim Henson's The Dark Crystal.
Wow. I have to tell you, Patrick, you are not allowed to do that. You have to finish your next book first.
I found out about this, and the first thing I asked the person at Henson, I said, "Is this can professional authors enter this as well?" And she goes, "Yes, professionals or amateurs or people in between." And I said, I was quiet, and I thought, I can't do it. There would be too much of a wailing and gnashing of teeth.
Yes, there would.
probably mostly from my editor
and Rob and I.
Yes.
Well, that'll be interesting to see what happens with that for sure.
Yeah, that's weird. I mean, kind of crowdsourcing this new thing in that old line. How often does that happen?
This is extraordinarily new because they're not just doing it by themselves. They're teaming up with Penguin. And if you want more details, you can, if you just Google up darkcrystal.com, it'll take you right to, they're calling it Author Quest. And since this doesn't even start until October, all you writers out there have a chance to actually start turning your hand towards producing something now, and you have a couple of months before you even have to think about submitting.
And I'll tell you what, we'll put a link to that on our Central Time Facebook page as well, so you can look for that. And Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll have you back on again.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll announce the title of the segment next time you're on with us. That was Patrick Rothfuss, best-selling author of The Name of the Wind and the ensuing King Killer Chronicle. It's a trilogy. We're waiting for the third book now. He's a proud bannerman of geek culture.
And coming up, student loan interest rates doubled yesterday. We'll talk about what happened and how it adds to the financial burden facing students. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. Yesterday was not a good day for Americans who rely on student loans to pay for college.
That's right. Interest rates on federally subsidized loans doubled from 3.4% to 6.8%.
And that's despite the fact that members of both parties in Congress have spoken out to prevent the doubling.
Here with us to discuss that now is Scott Ross. He's executive director of One Wisconsin Now, which recently published a study on the levels of student debt in the United States. He joins us from our Milwaukee studio. Scott, thanks
for joining
us.
Hey, Rob. Hey, how you doing?
Good. So why did student loan rates double yesterday?
Well, they doubled. Congress couldn't come to a reasonable and responsible solution. What we saw was House Republicans passed a plan that actually would have increased student loan debt by almost $16 billion. And Senate Democrats were thwarted with a filibuster when they tried to pass an extension of the 3.4% interest rates. So it was really it was a very unfortunate set of circumstances. And it's going to cost $159,000 borrowers across the state of Wisconsin more money out of their pockets that could otherwise be spent in the economy.
And now you've already, even before this doubling, been talking about the high load of student debt. What kind of impact is that having on us here in Wisconsin before we even talk about that doubling?
Well, it's utterly crushing. I mean, again, remember that, you know, back in 2000, we had a total of about $200 billion worth of student loan debt in the United States. And now we have over $1.1 trillion. And it's happened because of a lot of reasons. I mean, it's happened because of privatization. It's happened because of the stripping away of consumer protections after heavy and intense lobbying by Wall Street. It's happened as a result of the investment by state governments going down in terms of higher education. And it's also happened because of skyrocketing tuition. And so the economic impact of this is enormous. And we did a study last year in the state of Wisconsin that showed that, for instance, if you have a student loan, you are two-thirds more likely to be a renter as opposed to a homeowner. You're two-thirds more likely to purchase a used car instead of a new car. And in fact, we lose about $200 billion in new car purchasing power in the state of Wisconsin directly because of student loan debt. And then there's the intangible costs. For instance, how many young people with incredible skills, incredible enthusiasm, are getting out of college riddled with decades-long student loan debt who are then unable to, for instance, take their knowledge and skills and open up a small business with a couple of their friends? That we have not been able to see the economic economic cost of that is, but it's huge.
Talking to Scott Ross with One Wisconsin Now about student loan debt. Student loan interest rates doubled yesterday. And we're talking about how those debts are impacting people here in Wisconsin. And you can tell us about that. Tell us your story. Do you feel weighed down by student debt? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is this keeping you from switching jobs? Is it keeping you from making a big purchase, contributing to the economy in some way? 800-642-1234 or send an email at talk@wpr.org. Scott, I've talked to you about this before, and you've made the case that there's a basic philosophical issue here about the value we put on higher education and the expectation we put on students to pay for it. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think we have to ask ourselves a couple questions, Rob. One, is public education going to remain a public good that's supported by the public? Two, what do we do about the existing $1 trillion of student loan debt? And how do we keep that from growing to $2 trillion by the end of the decade, which is what's projected? And third, what are the real economic impacts of this massive, never-before-seen student loan debt having on our economy? And I think those are three really, really important questions. Student loan debt is very clear. It's a clear and present danger to Wisconsin's economy, to the national economy. And it's a situation that's never existed before. We have never seen people graduating from, you know, higher education and technical college with nearly two decades of debt as an average. So people are not only paying an exorbitant amount to get a higher education or get, you know, skills training, but they're having to pay it over, you know, what is essentially a generation, as opposed to how it was in the past, where a lot of people would work over the summer to pay for their tuition. And that's not the case anymore. It's simply not. And it's, you know, our students are doing the responsible thing. You know, they're trying to get a means into the middle class. They're doing higher education. They're doing technical college training. They're playing by the rules. The problem is that the game has totally changed, and it's not their fault.
Now, is there something different about student loans as opposed to other kinds of debt? Different laws, different regulations apply, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, you know how if you have a mortgage and like right now when interest rates are historically low, you could go and try and refinance your mortgage? You can't do that with student loans because it's specifically prohibited. So our students aren't able to take advantage of the free market when it comes to student loans. Another thing is if you have to declare bankruptcy and you have a student loan, you still don't lose that student loan. There's no statute of limitations when it comes to student loans. So, for instance, you know, we've got four crimes which they have no statute of limitations. Those are kidnapping, murder, treason, and war crimes. And now essentially student loans. That's where we put them in terms of the severity of a lack of statute of limitations.
things haven't always been that way. How did student loans become this special category of financial aid?
Well, there's not a naturally powerful constituency out there fighting in Washington, D.C. to make sure that, you know, borrowers are protected. You know, they're fighting against Wall Street, which is probably the most awesome force in the nation, on the planet. And Wall Street always gets its way. And so, for instance, you know, you can have a banks get charged 0.75% from the Federal Reserve to borrow money, but they can charge people with student loans as much as 12-15% for those student loans. So the system is just utterly and completely weighted against borrowers. And that again comes at a time when we've seen tuition double in the last 10 years.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Heather in Racine with us. Heather, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good. What's your story?
Well, one comment I'd like to make is when student loans were brought into the government fold, we were told that they were going to increase the grants available to students, and we've not seen that happen.
And do you work in the industry, Heather?
I do. I work in financial aid at a university in Wisconsin.
And so there are more loans, the government is in it, but we're not seeing more grants. Do you see that putting more of a burden on the students who are applying for aid at your university?
Well, certainly. But what I think is too bad, and I think that the public really doesn't know, is that when the banks were managing the loans, the interest rates were much lower, certainly, than they are now at 6.9%. Plus, borrowers who were making their payments on time received a repayment benefit, a reduction in their interest rate. And we don't see that with the government.
Gotcha. Heather, thank you so much for the call. Scott, your thoughts on what you had to say.
Well, I think the banks and the federal government, you know, you may not know this, but the banks and the federal government are making tens of billions of dollars. That's billion with a B, off of the interest from student loan rates. And in fact, you know, the federal government is set to make $51 billion off of the interest from student loans this year. To put that in perspective, how much money that is, in 2012, ExxonMobil, which is the largest corporation in the United States, made $46 billion. So they're making a massive amount of money off of this. And if they are going to make, you know, first of all, I think it's obscene that they're making that kind of money, but that should be put back into financial aid. And I think that she's right. You know, the need for financial aid has not kept up with the skyrocketing cost of higher education. And I think that that's one of the many solutions that that we need to engage in order to get higher education financing back into some semblance of sanity.
Thanks a lot for the call, Heather. We'll go now to Megan in Eau Claire. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. What's your story?
My story is that I graduated about a year ago, and I went for quite a bit longer than some of my friends, but I have about half my friends that just started businesses out of high school and own houses, have great careers, make, you know, $20 plus an hour. And all of my friends that have graduated college are still looking for jobs. They can't get mortgages. They're stuck in the rent trap. And it's we're in far, far worse position than people that were not educated at a higher level. And it seems like it's almost punishing us for we have this huge, massive debt and this degree that's almost useless now with the economy the way it is. And jobs, at least in this location in Wisconsin.
Gotcha. Megan, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, your response to what she has to say.
Well, I think Megan's story is a sad reality of where we're at right now. I mean, there's a reason we have, you know, 37 million people with student loan debt out there. And it's because, you know, we haven't done what's necessary in order to make sure that higher education nowadays is a ticket into the middle class. And, you know, again, Megan's playing by the rules. Went to college, got a degree, and now she's saddled, you know, in particularly in the state of Wisconsin, in an economy where we're, you know, dead last in job creation. So it's going to be even more exacerbated here.
We're talking to Scott Ross with One Wisconsin Now. He's the executive director there. And there's still time for your calls. He's going to stick with us after the break. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if the lines fill up again right away, remember you can go to the Central Time Facebook page. Share your thoughts, share your story, and share your questions. We might be able to get them in before the end of the hour. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Scott is going to stick with us, and then we'll talk about another educational issue, how to learn things quickly. The first 20 hours, we're going to talk to the author of that book.
That's right. That author has learned how to play ukulele, how to windsurf, how to play the Chinese game Go, and how to have a pretty decent yoga practice, and all by just putting in 20 hours of effort. So not a lot for a lot of payback there.
And we're going to probably do some homework here. We may commit ourselves to learn something. Veronica has something on her mind for me to learn. I still haven't decided whether I'm going to commit to it or not.
You'll have to stick around to find out what that is, but it's worth it.
Right. So more on student loans coming up after the news, and then the first 20 minutes, how to learn skills quickly. Hey, you're listening to Central Time, our still quite new show, our afternoon drive show here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And there's more to come. Stay with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. We'll continue our discussion now with Scott Ross of One Wisconsin Now. We're talking about student loan debt. The news yesterday, student interest rates for student loans, I should say, doubled 3.4% up to 6.8%. And Scott Ross says that's an added burden to students already facing a heavy load on their student debt. And he says that's hurting our economy as those people put off things like buying a house, buying a car, adding to the economy in other ways. We'll get back to your calls in just a moment at 800-642-1234 in just a moment. Scott, before we do that, though, what would you like to see change to fix the problem you're describing?
Sure. There's a couple things we can do. Really important steps that need to be taken. I think that we should allow for the refinancing of student loans like you can do with mortgages, for instance. I think we should create a tax deduction for the interest for student loans like you have for your mortgage. I think we need to expand federal college grants for students who qualify. I think we need to set loan rates at the same low rates that, you know, banks get from the Federal Reserve. I think we should limit state tuition increases to the rate of inflation. You know, and I think, you know, we should limit loan payments to maybe 10% of your income so that you can still afford to, you know, live. I think those are some real common sense, fair-minded steps that allow students, you know, to continue to be personally responsible for their student loans, but also recognize that, you know, the system is broken. Those changes that were made sent us on a pathway of, you know, long-term economic destruction, and that we care enough about having a strong and vibrant middle class that we're going to make changes that need to be made.
That's what you want to see happen. Where's the constituency? Who is going to call for those changes up against the financial industry interests that you were talking about earlier?
Well, what I'm thinking is the 37 million people who have this student loan debt have to use their voices and recognize that, you know, they're not alone in this. You know, that there's a, you know, it's over 10% of the population currently in, you know, in a sense of indentured servitude over student loan debt. I mean, we know it, you know, from the things that we hear. I mean, we have had people calling our office with just incredibly heartbreaking stories about their student loan debt, you know, because they just wanted to get a higher education. And we actually have a website dedicated to many of those stories, not just from the state of Wisconsin, but from all corners of the United States, and that is at trilliondollardebt.com. If people want to go and read some real heartbreak, if you want to make yourself feel much better about your situation, you can go and read some of these horrible stories. But again, in that comes, you know, a united sense of purpose, and that is that we have to do something about this because the middle class cannot continue if it costs every dime you have simply to get an education, because education is the key to the middle class. And unfortunately, what we've seen, for instance, here in the state of Wisconsin, just over the last couple of years, we saw enormous cuts to the University of Wisconsin system. We saw a 30% cut to our technical college system. And we saw tuition go up by over $100 million. That is not going to get us on the right path.
We'll go back to the phones now with Bob in Fifield. Hi there, Bob.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I've had my daughter and son-in-law both went to college, and I signed for a student loan for my son-in-law Because of he had Crohn's disease, he couldn't finish college through his lack of attendance. I'm burdened with about a $15,000 debt that it affects my credit report.
Well, Bob, I want to get, we just got time for a couple more callers. I want to get a response, Scott. Bob's saying it's not just the students, it's the parents who co-sign the loans that are hurting here.
Oh, and we've heard Bob's story before, and it's terrifying. I mean, you know, one thing that you may not know is that you can have your Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt, including mm-hmm. disability payments. So, for instance, in our United States of America, last year, 120,000 people over the age of 60 had their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt.
Thanks a lot for the call, Bob. We'll go now to Stephanie in Eau Claire. Stephanie, hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I actually just moved here from Pittsburgh. I graduated with a degree in graphic design, which obviously isn't the best field, but I'm lucky enough to be employed. And one of the experiences that I had with my husband and I was that not only is it really hard to pay the loans, they make the interface online confusing so that you accidentally double pay or think that you didn't pay. But also, we've had trouble with they won't take into consideration your income, where like when we were making right out of school like $11 an hour, we were still paying $600 a month. I don't know if there's a way to solve that and tie that into legislation, or if that's just on the banks, or if there's any solution.
Scott, any solution?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I know that the president, you know, part of their reforms on student loans to keep people from defaulting included some income-based repayment, and I would encourage you to look into that. But this is how slimy the field is. Is that they're actually, now that the income-based repayment is out there and allowed, there are actually people who are advertising saying, hey, if you pay us money, we'll help you access this. So a service that is available by the government, you know, people are trying to make money off of that even. And just let me give Stephanie a shout-out because I, too, am from Pittsburgh.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Stephanie. We have an email from Sabine. She writes, I do feel financial pressure for my student debt. I studied for 5 years and owe about $50,000 to the government right now. I dread graduation, she writes, because that's when I will be cut loose and have to begin paying it back. For many people, the prospect of this kind of debt forces people who go to college to narrow their choices down to a course of study that guarantees a steady income, like healthcare or engineering. Scott?
Well, I mean, our elected officials understand one thing, and that is when we use our voice collectively. And so I would encourage people to find, you know, people who are supporting issues when it comes to student loan debt and make sure that you support, you know, support them. And, you know, those who are not, you know, you hold them accountable. I mean, that's the way we're going to get real change, because there's change that needs to be made by the federal government. There's change that needs to be made by the state government. And let me just say this. This is not a partisan problem. It was created by both parties, the situation, and it's only going to be solved if both parties work together and try and come up with real solutions that are going to put economic power back into the hands of young people getting out of college.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much, and congrats on the new show.
Thanks a lot. That was Scott Ross. He's executive director of One Wisconsin Now.
Up next, we'll check the headlines, and then our next guest teaches us how to learn things fast. Apparently, all it takes is 20 hours to get a good start on mastering a new skill. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, it's On Point. Tom Ashbrook will discuss the new peer-to-peer sharing economy, from renting out your power tools to even renting out rooms in your house. That's tomorrow on Point in its new home from 9 to 11 on the Ideas Network.
And here's a check of the latest headlines.
Security and hospital officials say 7 people have been killed in clashes between supporters and opponents of Egypt's Islamist president in Cairo. The officials say the 7 were killed in 3 separate clashes, but had no further details. Clashes come one day before a military deadline warning President Mohamed Morsi and his opponents to work out their differences, or the army will intervene with its own political roadmap to resolve the crisis. Investigators are in the Arizona mountain town of Yarnell to figure out why 19 elite firefighters perished in an out-of-control wildfire and whether human error played a role in the tragedy. The investigation will look at whether the hotshot crew paid attention to the forecast, created an escape route and took other precautions developed after a similar disaster in Colorado nearly two decades ago. Western Wisconsin military base is set to begin furloughs next week to absorb federal spending cuts. Fort McCoy plans to furlough most of its 1,500 civilian employees.
You'll hear more news at 5 o'clock. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're tuned into Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Now, I love learning new things. I love it. And that's part of why I like my job, by the way. But between my job and my kids and my band, I don't have a lot of time to spare to just go out and really master a new skill.
Time gets scarce, that's for sure. I've been wanting to teach myself guitar for about, 5 years now. But I don't feel like I have the time to invest to get, decent enough to play down in the valley.
So we're going to talk with Josh Kaufman. He's author of The First 20 Hours. His book is about how you can learn any new skill, or at least get a start on that new skill, in just 20 hours. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Robin, Veronica. Great to be with you.
Glad to have you. Now, why did you decide at how to learn new skills as fast as possible?
Personal need, actually. So just like you, I'm really busy with my job. I have my own business. My wife has her own business. And we had our daughter, Leela. And all of a sudden, I had zero free time. And so, I figured if I was only able to invest 30 or 45 minutes a day, I wanted to know how to invest that time as effectively as possible. And that research became my new book, The First 20 Hours.
Well, because the statistics that we hear about what you need to do to learn a new skill, to get that mastery, it's something crazy like 10,000 hours. And when I hear that, I just want to put my head in my hands and cry. So what's
right.
The good news there?
Common misconception. That research is based on what's called mastering a skill. So if you want to become the best in the world at something, so for example, step on a golf course and be able to compete with Tiger Woods, it's going to take you about 10,000 hours to get there. That's what the research says. But if you just want to pick up a skill that is interesting or valuable to you, you can go from knowing absolutely nothing to getting the results that you want in way less time. And my research indicates that period of time is about 20 hours.
So what are the steps, some of the steps, anyway, to learning something really fast?
Sure. The basic method behind the first 20 hours is very simple. And the first thing is to decide what you want to do. What do you want to be able to do when you're done? I call this a target performance level. And the more specific you are about what it is you want to be able to do, the easier it is to find ways to practice in a way that will get you there. From there, you deconstruct the skill. So a lot of the things that we want to do for ourselves, like playing the guitar or speaking a language or learning to draw, they're not just one skill. They're bundles of much smaller sub-skills. And if you are able to figure out what those sub-skills are, you can practice those directly. And if you practice the most important sub-skills first, you improve extremely quickly.
Well, so walk us through one of these. You took on several of them for your book. What is, pick maybe the hardest one for you to get through using your new technique?
The hardest one for me was I learned how to windsurf, believe it or not, which I had never done before. And so everything from figuring out which gear to buy to how to set it up to how to, stand on a floating piece of styrofoam in the middle of a lake on a windy day holding, this big sail upright, it was all foreign to me. And so, just like any skill, at the beginning, you're terrible, and you know it. So I fell a lot, and I drank a lot of lake water, but it didn't take very long to figure out how to do it in a way that I was able to go out in the middle of the lake and come back and have fun doing it.
And in the 20 hours you had, you didn't, you're not about to enter any international windsurfing competitions, but you got it down well enough to not look like an idiot every time you hit the water?
Exactly. So the point in windsurfing for me is to go out and be safe and have fun doing it. And so to get to the level that I wanted to get to, it took far less time. And so, for the book, I learned computer programming, touch typing. I learned how to play the ukulele. And windsurfing and yoga and all sorts of other fascinating things.
So there's a moment in a video that we watched of you learning to windsurf where it's clear that you have kind of hit a wall and you kind of collapse on your surfboard and you look like you want to just give up and roll into fetal position. And I think all of us know what that's like when we start something new. you feel kind of bad about yourself, and it's rough, and it's hard being worse than anyone else at this thing you're trying to learn. How do you get past that?
Yeah, there are two really major barriers to learning something new. And the first one is just getting started in the first place. So if you don't know where to start, the whole thing just feels very intimidating. That's a big barrier to getting started. But in the first few hours, if you can get yourself to start, the first few hours, you're always terrible, and you know it. And so a large part of the method is making sure that you structure the practice in a way that to make it easy to get started and easy to persist, and you're able to figure out a way to keep going through those inevitable frustrations at the beginning.
Now, I think a lot of us have probably been in the moment thinking, I'd love to do blank or learn blank. I don't have the time. I can't find the time. How do you tackle the time issue?
Yeah, so if you look at your schedule, I recommend just taking a notebook, and for a couple days, just write down how you spend your time every day. And what you'll find is there are a couple of areas where you can probably cut out things that aren't providing a whole lot of value to you right now. A really wonderful place to start is TV. So if you can set aside half an hour or 45 minutes that you would otherwise watch TV and invest it in developing this skill that you've always wanted to be able to do, and you do that for about a month, that's about 20 hours. And that's really all it takes. If you invest the time and you practice in a smart way, you can go from knowing absolutely nothing to being very reasonably good in a very short period of time.
But what if the skill is watching TV and I want to get really good at it? Or doesn't that count?
Yeah.
I've got that one mastered, actually, anyway.
Right.
Well, another thing you did was you developed a yoga practice. Now, flexibility does not come fast and easy, but you managed to do it. So how did you break that one down into little steps?
Yeah, the big thing for me there was I had a fundamental misunderstanding of what yoga was and why it was valuable. And so, you know, skill in yoga is not necessarily being able to bend over and touch your toes or touch the floor. It's being able to move and breathe and keep your mind on a specific subject at a time. And so when I dug into yoga, I found very quickly that what I thought yoga was at the beginning and what yoga actually is was completely different. And when I understood what yoga actually was, which is, you know, movement and breathing in a mindful mental state, it didn't take me very long at all to be able to put together a routine so I could practice at home. And it only took me about 3 hours. And it was something that I was anticipating was going to be this big, crazy, huge project.
So are you still practicing this stuff? Are you still doing your yoga practice? Or now that you've kind of gotten a degree of proficiency, do you leave these things by the wayside?
No, I actually, so I learned 6 skills for the book. I am still doing 5 of them. So I'm still playing the ukulele. I'm still doing yoga. I'm still programming. I'm still touch typing on my crazy keyboard. And I'm still windsurfing. The one that I'm not doing, I learned it's a fascinating game, the ancient Chinese board game Go, which is actually the oldest and most complex board game in the world. I learned how to play that for the book as well. And that was one of the things that, you know, I learned a lot, I improved a lot, and I was able to make the decision that of all of the things that are in my life right now, it would be more valuable for me to spend my time elsewise. So I'm glad I scratched that itch of curiosity in learning how to play the game. And I made the decision that I would much rather spend my time windsurfing.
We've got a call now from Scott in Iron River. Scott, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I wanted to share. I've been playing guitar. I started when I was 19. And the guitar teacher that I had, he just suggested that I practice 5 minutes a day and take one little step at a time. And I said, 5 minutes, really? And he said, yep, 5 minutes. So the next week I go back and ask me how that went. And what I found was you sit down with the intention of playing for 5 minutes. Well, I can handle that.
Yep.
And easily 5 minutes turns into 30 minutes, 45, sometimes an hour. And you learn to take one little step at a time. And I was off and running. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made in my life. So,
Scott, that's a great story. Yeah.
I love that story. Actually, I recommend a similar technique. So to just get like a kitchen timer, some very basic countdown timer. And for me, I always set aside like 20 minutes. So I make sure that I'm not going to be distracted and push the button to start the timer. And the only rule is when I push the button on the timer, I can't do anything else. So if I'm going to be frustrated or I'm not making progress, I'm going to be frustrated for about 20 minutes. And it makes it much easier to get started, and it makes it much easier to push through when the going gets rough.
So you're someone who loves learning. This is obviously something you enjoy doing. But did you ever feel guilty that you were dabbling in these things when you could have been going for that 10,000 hours of complete mastery? You could have been the best possible windsurfer in the world.
You know, I actually think mastery is severely overrated. And you know, because being able to explore something you're interested in and get good so you can enjoy it or get something useful out of that, there's a lot of value in that. And I think, you know, at the beginning, it's very easy to be distracted by the whole idea of mastering or becoming the best in the world. And that becomes a very real barrier to sitting down and learning something that may provide a lot of value in your life. So, no, I love exploring lots of things. And there are certain things, like, for example, I found a lot of value in programming. I now run my entire business on software that I wrote myself, and I'm continuing to do it. And I'm about, at this point, about 120 hours into it.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's by exploring a lot of different things, you may find that thing that really provides a lot of usefulness or enjoyment for you.
I wanted to ask about the idea of getting an instructor, or at least somebody to give you feedback, because I think of something, especially like doing yoga. If I tried to do it on my own, even with the best video in the world, I would be doing it incredibly wrong and break my nose or something. How do you make the decision, I need some help on this one, I don't need help on that one?
Yeah, so in general, movement-type skills really benefit from instruction. And the reason is the way we think we're moving our body and how we're actually moving our body are often two very different things. And so having an outside instructor who can watch you as you're practicing and make adjustments or give you corrections is wonderful. Likewise, for extremely complex skills, particularly when safety is an issue, having an instructor is great. So I actually, just this past week, I talked to a gentleman in Pennsylvania who learned how to fly an airplane in 16 and a half hours.
Ooh.
And that was knowing nothing about aviation to his first solo flight, 16 and a half hours. And the only reason he was able to do that is because he was working with a really good instructor that was helping him break down the skill into manageable parts and make sure that he was being safe in the process.
Well, Josh, I want to ask you, now I okayed this with Rob ahead of time.
Oh, man.
There is a skill that Rob would like to acquire that he does not yet have. And I've been trying to encourage him to do it, as I'm sure others have, like his children. Rob does not know how to ride a bike yet.
I was a stubborn 5-year-old.
And okay. He, you know, it would be nice to ride a bike with his family, I'm sure. What can he do? How should he start?
Okay, so one of the best things you can do at the beginning. Well, first off, do you have a bike?
No. It seemed pointless not knowing how to ride.
I can loan you a bike.
Okay. So there's a reason I ask that, because, you know, just like a lot of people say that I want to learn how to play the piano, and you ask them if they have a piano, and they say no, you have to have the tools, right? So first step is get a bike. Second step is you can break down the whole process into smaller parts. So one of the ways that you might do that is, for example, just get the bike, adjust it to your size, and just practice balancing on the bike, no moving. So just very stationary, keep it up, put your feet on the pedals, and just get the feel for what it feels like going back and forth trying to balance on two wheels. So you can break it down that way, and, you know, then you just add certain elements on top of it. And just, you know, practice for 20 or so minutes at a time. Give yourself a break and maybe practice 20 or so more minutes, and you'll get there.
It doesn't sound so bad.
the whole thing is, you know, the entire method revolves around practicing in a way that is not frustrating and not intimidating, doing what works, and not doing all of the things that distract you from acquiring the skill that you really want to pick up. And so I would highly recommend this is something that you can do.
Josh, I think you've just about persuaded me. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Josh Kaufman, author of The First 20 Hours, How to Learn Anything Fast.
And maybe we'll post videos of Rob learning how to ride the... No, we probably won't.
We shan't be doing that.
We won't be doing that.
But maybe I'll try it, and we will give oral histories of my efforts, and maybe we'll post pictures of my various injuries and wounds.
Excellent.
Presentable for radio.
Have the courage to try. Coming up next, we'll talk to an expert about internet addiction, and that's coming up after this news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Remember, you can always check us out on the Central Time Facebook page. Post your thoughts about what we're talking about or what you'd like us to talk about in the future. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.